Hi, everyone. I'm Shamitha Basu, in for Tanzina Vega, who's on maternity leave. I'm here at my apartment working remotely, and it's really good to be here with you on The Takeaway. Across the country, states are starting to relax restrictions put in place due to COVID-19, even as the number of confirmed cases continues to climb and the death toll surpasses 67,000 people. Experts say the pandemic could go on for another 2 years, with subsequent waves of infection in the fall and winter. Still, that hasn't stopped places like Georgia and Texas from allowing businesses to reopen. On Friday, Governor Brian Kemp lifted the stay-at-home order for most of Georgia's residents, with an exception for people who are elderly or, quote, medically fragile, who are required to shelter in place through June 12th. We'll talk more about Georgia's reopening on this show in the coming days. And elsewhere in the country, stay-at-home orders are still going strong. But in states like California and Michigan, government officials are facing increasing backlash from protesters who want things to return to normal. So far, the protests have been limited in size, and people participating range from anti-vaccination activists to far-right extremists using the pandemic to push forward white supremacy. Still, these protests and the reopening process in general raise serious questions about when and how states should resume business as usual, and what happens if we reopen too soon. For more on this, we're joined by Caitlin Rivers, an epidemiologist at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, and Jeremy Ude, global health politics expert and dean of the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Minnesota Duluth. Thank you both for coming on the program.
Thanks for the invitation.
Good to be
here. Caitlin, I think a lot of people hear reopen and think that means go completely back to normal. So what does reopening state by state mean to you?
That's right. Reopening is not going to be a light switch where one day we wake up and are able to do all of our normal activities. It's going to be a slow reincorporation of community activities back into our lives. And so we might start with things that are low risk, like more outdoor activities, maybe some essential shopping locations. The businesses that are asked to reopen first will vary state by state, but it certainly will not be all at once. And then as we take that first step and start to reincorporate those activities, if things go well, we can start to do more, and we will proceed like that slowly.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jeremy, a lot of the governors who are talking about reopening their states as quickly as possible keep saying that it's an economic necessity. How fair is it to be thinking of this as a sort of zero-sum game, economic health versus public health?
Well, I think if we frame it in that perspective, we actually lose out on the bigger picture here. It's not about economics versus public health. It's that economics and public health need to be working together. And so if we think about this in terms of, well, we have to do this for the economy, we're losing sight of the fact that if we reopen too quickly, what we're likely to do is to see another wave that comes later on in the year, and that wave could be as bad, if not worse, than what we're currently experiencing. So even though there are the pains right now that go along with having these restrictions in place, it's actually going to be better for us in the long run as opposed to opening up too quickly.
Caitlin, the federal government has released some guidelines on the reopening process, including the criteria to consider. And I've heard a lot of elected officials cite new cases per day as a meaningful metric when thinking about when to reopen. Is that the right way to think about it?
Yes, we do want to see the epidemic start to slow before we consider reopening, and keeping an eye on the number of new cases each day is one way to do that. Other metrics that are important are the number of people hospitalized, both currently and new hospitalizations each day, and the number of deaths. And again, those all help us to understand whether we are in the acceleration phase or whether our staying home to slow the spread has begun to break chains of transmission and slow the epidemic.
Mm-hmm. Caitlin, what are some of the approaches to reopening that we're seeing here in the U.S.? And as I mentioned earlier, Georgia was the first state to start doing this.
So there are decisions about what industries or what segments of the economy can reopen, and that does vary state by state. We've seen in Georgia that they are leisure activities, personal services. Other states have chosen to focus more on businesses. And so there are decisions that will vary about what will be allowed to reopen. But there's another side, which is what is the public health approach to keep the community safe during that reopening. And that side focuses really a lot on diagnostic testing and contact tracing. Those are the tools that will allow us to control transmission during that reopening process. And that second public health part is pretty widely understood, pretty widely shared among states. And again, that's diagnostic testing and contact tracing.
Yeah, so tell me where we stand on those two things right now. I know that Georgia has been saying the past few days that they've pretty significantly ramped up testing, but that's also from a very low number of tests earlier. How are states doing on testing and contact tracing?
We have seen a pretty substantial expansion in our testing capacity. Last week, the United States ran about 1.6 million tests, which is a great improvement over what we saw even earlier in April, but it's still not to the level that many experts recommend. Recommendations range from about 3.5 million tests a week and go up from there. And so there is still more room to grow. And I think that's important to make sure that we're not just finding people with severe illness, but really everybody with COVID-like symptoms. And again, that's to enable the second piece, which is contact tracing. We have estimated, along with the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials, that the U.S. will need about 100,000 additional contact tracers, and states have begun to make moves towards hiring those contact tracers. Again, this is happening at the state level, and so the movement to hire those varies from place to place, but there are efforts underway to expand our capacity to do that.
What kind of skill set do you need to be a contact tracer?
We recommend that contact tracers be familiar with the local community, and they need to be comfortable with conducting interviews and collecting data. It is a skilled position, but it's the kind of skill you can teach through maybe a day course or a couple day course, and so it's quite approachable. This is also a good opportunity to hire people who have not been able to work, perhaps because they've lost their job because of the pandemic.
Now, when we think about vaccines and therapeutics and the timelines for those, how does that factor into how states can think about their plans to reopen?
It's unlikely that we will have an effective therapeutic or vaccine in time to affect reopening plans. You probably heard in the news recently that a new product by Gilead is becoming an option for treatment, which is exciting, but that product is used late in the course of illness, so when people are already quite sick. In order for a therapeutic to be useful to break transmission and to influence the epidemiology, we need something earlier in the course of illness, and unfortunately, that's not available yet.
Jeremy, how much of a role is public pressure playing in reopening states, like what we're seeing with some of these protests, even though they're fairly small in scope?
Yeah, I think we can't underestimate the role that public pressure is playing. And I think you hit the nail on the head when you said that a lot of these protests that we have seen are actually other political movements that are glomming on to this. But in a lot of places, you are starting to see more of this public demonstration that's taking place, and governors are starting to feel pressure. And I think what's actually going to be really complicated about this or pose a lot of problems is that if we're going to do this sort of reopening, governors have to be willing to step that back. If the testing is showing that we are seeing an increase in the number of cases or the number of hospitalizations is going up, governors are going to have to be able to make that potentially difficult political choice to say, okay, I know we opened up businesses, but we need to close some of those back down because we're seeing too much community spread. And that's going to take a whole huge amount of political skill in order to be able to walk that back in the face of that potential political and public pressure.
Mm-hmm. Caitlin, what do we know about the best practices around easing out of a lockdown?
In terms of walking back restrictions, we don't have a great template because we are in a place we have never been before. We have never asked everyone to stay home before. And so the exact right moves, I think, are still a little bit uncertain. But we recommend that states start with low-risk activities. Again, those might be things that are outdoors, things where social distancing is very possible. Make those first few moves and see how things go, because it's much easier to pull back from low-risk activities that are unlikely to cause a great deal of transmission than to dive in with a mass gathering, for example, that might result in a lot of secondary cases. And then again, you are in a place where you have a lot of community transmission and you have created the conditions that led us all having to stay home in the first place. And so it's really about starting with low-risk activities and proceeding slowly.
Jeremy, what lessons can we learn from other countries that have already started the reopening process? You know, for example, I'm thinking about Singapore, and maybe you want to bring up other examples, but Singapore was praised as having handled things really well from the start. They were testing extensively, there was contact tracing happening there, but now the number of new cases per day is just shooting up there.
Yeah, you know, Singapore is a great example, I think, of the potential issues that can come up with this reopening, because as you pointed out, they received a lot of praise for their early and aggressive actions, but we are seeing the second wave of cases. And one of the things I think is really interesting about the Singapore case is that it is highlighting some of the existing social cleavages that exist within Singapore. So a lot of the new cases that are popping up in Singapore are happening among migrant workers who are oftentimes living in less than ideal conditions. And so it's reflecting some of these other sorts of social, political, and economic divisions that exist within society. So there are some issues there, but you know, we can look to countries like South Korea, which again, lots of testing, lots of contact tracing that has enabled these sorts of moves to be able to move forward. And we're seeing some real potentially positive signs coming out of Australia and New Zealand. Even earlier today, they were talking about how they're thinking about creating a travel bubble where people who are in Australia or New Zealand would be able to travel between the two countries, but there still might be restrictions for people coming from other places. But again, it's that ability to do the testing, the ability to do that contact tracing, and then the ability to use those data that are collected in order to inform the policymaking process that's going to be so incredibly vital for making this something that works.
Caitlin, here on The Takeaway, we've been talking about the disproportionate impact of the pandemic on low-income communities, on people of color, especially Black Americans. Should we assume that reopening too soon would only further impact these populations the most?
It's true that health disparities play out in so many different ways. So I think one of the key pieces of missing data right now is understanding where people are getting infected even during being asked to stay home. And I suspect that people who are still considered essential workers and participating in community activities are at higher risk. And those will largely be under-resourced communities, communities of color, low-wage workers. And so when we do reintroduce more community activities, it will be still those people at risk. And so I think it's really important that we understand how and why new cases are arising so that we can take additional steps to protect people in those settings. Underlying health conditions and other factors that put people at risk for infection and for severe illness, again, disproportionately affect under-resourced communities. And so I do think we will continue to see that show up in the epidemiology.
Dr. Caitlin Rivers is an epidemiologist at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. And Jeremy Yood is a global health politics expert and dean of the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Minnesota Duluth. Thank you both for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Thank you.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.